Welcome to installment number 102 of New World Notes, which is titled, Not All Christians Are Evil. I know the church has been doing its best to disguise the fact, but please hear me out. At best, the Christian church as an institution has failed to come even close to living up to its pious rhetoric. It is deeply corrupt. It has sold out. In every instance it has come in conflict with mammon, it has chosen mammon. It has erected golden calves on every altar and told the parishioners that God commands them to bow down and worship the idol. Okay, now that's the kindest, most flattering interpretation. Perhaps a more balanced interpretation would be to say simply that the institutional church was created by Satan himself for the purpose of increasing human misery, slavery, sin, and suffering, and to turn people's attention away from all higher thoughts and kindly behavior. So there's the flattering interpretation of the church and the judicious interpretation. Are you ready for the really negative interpretation? I'm not either. As a boy, I was schlepped off to mainstream Protestant church service every week. Over the course of a year, I suffered hours of tedium, punctuated by minutes of fear and loathing. The worst was being forced to lie, and seeing a good deal of the town's establishment glibly lying away. The Apostles' Creed we were compelled to recite each week. The third day he arose from the dead, he ascended into heaven, and sitteth at the right hand of God the Father Almighty. Right. I am so familiar with protocol in heaven that I have a firm opinion of what the seating arrangements are. From thence he shall come to judge the quick and the dead. Did anybody ever bother to explain what quick meant back in the days of King James? No. I believe in the Holy Spirit, the Holy Catholic Church. Sidebar comment, that small c Catholic. The Holy Catholic Church. The communion of saints, the forgiveness of sins, the resurrection of the body, and the life everlasting. Amen. From the text, you might even be able to identify the exact Protestant denomination. For example, the Lutherans claim to believe that, between the crucifixion and the resurrection, quote, he descended into hell, unquote. Not us. We may end up in hell, but, so far as we're concerned, Christ never went near the place. They drank, too, the Lutherans. So you have 10-year-old boys swearing they believe in not only the seating arrangement in heaven, but the communion of saints and the Holy Catholic Church. What do these terms mean?
Who the heck knows?
Not any of the adults who are affirming their belief in same. Possibly the minister knew, though he wasn't sharing any ecclesiastical secrets with the rabble in the pews. As for the resurrection of the body, at age 10, I knew enough of the nitrogen cycle to recognize when I smelled it. Not only most improbable, but totally unnecessary. Rising from my grave, fully intact at some future date? What does this have to do with any precept of Christianity? It's completely unnecessary. A sideshow. What is this, another credo quia absurdum? I may be 10, but I'm not a total moron. So, what killed mainstream Christianity for me was the required weekly perjury. Other things were discordant, too. Why was the altar flanked by two flags, the so-called Christian flag and the American flag? Does this indicate some unanimity of purpose between the Christian Church and John Foster Dulles's State Department? And when is the Rev going to get around to saying something about Christianity and the civil rights movement taking place outside even as he speaks? Answer, never. But it was the weekly perjury that killed it for me. Isn't there a commandment or something saying, don't do that? But one obscure phrase in the Apostles' Creed held a clue to something higher. The Holy Catholic Church, small c. Sometimes the Rev even made the point in English, though he never sounded convinced of it. The church is not the stones and stained glass and flags flanking the golden calf on the altar, let alone the bishops and the pastors and the tax-exempt corporation that runs the show. The church is the congregants. The church is the people. The institutional church has disgraced itself damnably ever since it sold out to the Emperor Constantine in 312, if not earlier. But in all times, a small minority of people, acting on what they personally understand Christianity to be and to require, have done much good in the world. Not because of their private system of ethics as such, but simply because they believe that God requires them to do that, and more. In some cities in occupied Europe, at great risk to themselves, Gentiles harbored Jews in their homes, sharing what little food they were allotted, protecting them from being shipped off in boxcars by the Nazi occupiers. To cite some more modern examples, many people have fought for peace, social justice, economic justice, and political justice, not in order to earn a merit badge, but because they saw it as their religious duty. We're focusing on Christians, but they don't hold the patent. Rabbi Michael Lerner comes to mind, who has worked for years to bring justice for Palestine in the belief that murder and ethnic cleansing are betrayals of Judaism. In past episodes, we have celebrated, sometimes briefly, sometimes at length, Lerner and a few other worker prophets. Dan and Phil Berrigan, Martin Luther King Jr., Kathy Kelly, Jeremy Scahill, Chris Hedges, Yonatan Shapira. Let's hear from a few more today. For years, Ray McGovern was a high-ranking intelligence analyst at the CIA. Since retiring, he has worked tirelessly, trying to expose the lies our political masters use to justify plunging into more and more bloody and more evil wars of aggression. McGovern's arguments are mostly fact-based, logical, and secular. Every once in a while, though, he reveals that he once read an old book and took it seriously, and the old book seems to list 10 rules to follow, and our global war for petroleum seems to violate 5 or 6 of them. Here are parts of a conversation he had in November 2009 with that admirable radio guy in Seattle, Mike McCormick.
The troops that one does hear from serving in Afghanistan is, why are we there?
Ah, thanks, Mike. Nobody ever asked us that question. Well, let me talk about Iraq and Afghanistan. Iraq, there was a fellow who was CEO of Halliburton. I forget his name now. He became vice president. Dick Cheney's his name. And he made a big speech in 1998, and he said, look, people accuse us of being, of not being alert to the fact that we need more oil. They don't realize that the prize lies, those were his words, the prize lies in the Middle East, and most of that oil is controlled by governments that are unfriendly. So what do they want us to do, you know? Well, 2 years later, Dick Cheney comes into office as vice president, convenes this energy task force, and they figure out what to do. What to do is take advantage of this ruthless dictator in Baghdad, the fact that he's got no army, and the fact that he's easily attacked, and so they attack him with the hope that they can control the oil resources in Iraq. Now, anybody could have told them that they're not going to be able to do that, and they're not going to be able to do that. Those oil resources will be portioned out to lots of countries besides the United States. Now, how about Afghanistan? Well, we know that in 1999, the fellow who headed Enron, I think it was Ken Lay is his name, he wrote a nice little letter, which we have a copy of, to the governor of Texas. His name was George W. Bush. And he said, the Afghan ambassador is going to come and see you, and we've got a really interesting project going, a pipeline coming down from Turkmenistan down into the Indian Ocean that will go through Afghanistan and has to go through those mountains. But we got a route all, and the Taliban's going to come and talk to you, and we want you to listen to this very carefully because it's a really important project. There's going to be a lot of good money made on this, and we'll have a strategic position there because, well, he didn't say this in the letter, but I've learned subsequently that the natural gas in Turkmenistan, just to the north of Afghanistan, is worth more in dollars than all the oil under the sands of Iraq. Can you believe it? So that's what was planned, okay? This oil and gas pipeline will come down into the Indian Ocean. Now, I had a chance to ask the urbane and witty Zalmay Khalilzad, who is a big oil man, but was also our ambassador in Afghanistan and Iraq, at a meeting of RAND 2 weeks ago. I said, now, what about natural resources? What about the notion this might be a resource war, you know, like Iraq was the first resource war of the 21st century. Is Afghanistan the second? And he gulped and he said, well, I think that you can't be thinking about a pipeline through Afghanistan in the chaotic conditions that exist now. It needs to be tamped down. There needs to be some minimal security before that pipeline can go through. I'm thinking, well, does that mean that's why we have to make minimal security? I didn't get a chance to ask a follow-up, but there it was. You know, here's the guy who knows. So he was involved in these negotiations with the Taliban. So this is a major factor that is never mentioned. Nobody wants to think that that we're in it for the natural resources. But, you know, subconsciously, I think a lot of Americans realize, you know, when Bush or Cheney used to say, they're after our way of life. Okay. What does that mean? That mean $4 a gallon? $5 a gallon? You know? I think subconsciously, or maybe some people let me tell you about one person here, who consciously told me what he really thought. This was in Pewaukee, Wisconsin, right outside of Milwaukee. It's sort of like, you know, the real rich suburb of Milwaukee, okay? I'm giving a lecture there. I finish in about an hour, and I said I'd take more questions in the back because we had to stop. So there are about 30 people congregate around me, and this one very well-dressed middle-aged fellow comes up, and he says, "Mr. Montgomery, what's your problem? I don't understand what your problem is." And I said, "I beg your pardon?" He said, "Well, you don't deny the fact that we need the oil, do you?" I said, "Of course not. I mentioned oil." He says, "Well, then you have to admit that 3 or 4 U.S. troops killed every week is a very small price to pay for the oil that we need." Now, I had not heard anybody say it quite like that before. And he went on, he said, "You know, in Vietnam, we lost hundreds in a week. So, you know, what's your problem?" And I looked around, and I was hoping, you know, for kind of shocked looks, but nobody was shocked. Everybody's looking at me, what's McGovern going to say? So I think, you know, the utilitarian argument's going to work with this guy. I said, they're not going to let us get their oil, you know. We can try to, they're not going to let us, okay? And he said, "Oh, Mr. McGovern, we're the sole remaining superpower in the world. Give me a break. We can do what we want. We'll get their oil." So then I thought, well, I got angry. I said, "You know, well, suppose one of those GIs killed last week was your son." He said, "It wouldn't be my son." And that's the problem. That's the problem. It wouldn't be his son, okay? Then I got mad, and I said, "Well, you know, are you one of those who would like to have the Ten Commandments introduced in the courthouses and the, you know, the schools?" And this, "Oh, yeah, that would be a good idea." I said, "Well, I don't remember very, very distinctly, but I think there's one that says, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's oil, not oil, but goods. And another one says, thou shalt not steal. There's the one that says, thou shalt not kill. Another one says you shouldn't lie about what your objectives are. And there's even one, I think it's the first or the second one, that says, thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain, as if God would support the kind of war that you're justifying because we need oil." And so maybe you ought to subtract those 5. He ended up put 5 commandments in the school. Well, he got really, really angry, turned around, rushed out to his SUV, gunned it all up and peeled out of there, you know, using lots of oil just to peel out real quick. And I said to myself, wow, you know, there's a lesson to be learned there, because not only he, but all those, you know, the 29 others who were gathered around there didn't think that his question was beyond the pale. They were wondering how I would explain, how I would argue with the notion that, you know, 4 or 5 GIs killed in a given week was not worth, you know, the oil, the objective for oil. So natural resources are a major factor. The last thing I'll say on this subject, and it's something that I learned from my grandchildren. I learned lots from my grandchildren. This is from little Ronan, who was 4 at the time. I was helping in his nursery school, okay? And it was really neat, these little kids. So after it was all over, I went up to the teacher. I said, "What are you trying to teach 4-year-olds, you know?" And she said, "That's easy. We teach them that you need to share." And I said, Cheney and Bush never went to nursery school, at least not this nursery school. I mean, there's a finite amount of oil and natural gas in this world. And I believe that Iraq can be legitimately regarded as the first resource war of the 21st century. And unless we get together with the Chinese, with the Indians, with the other countries that are very powerful in that area, and say, look, we have to work out some sort of sensible arrangement. We have to learn how to share. there's going to be more and more wars, including the Afghanistan war. So, you know, hello, pretty basic, you know. We can't go in trying to control. We can't do it. We saw what happened in Iraq. What we need to do is to go in and say, all right, let's work this out. And you don't have a belligerent Soviet Union anymore. You have a Russia that's willing to work such things like that out. And you have a China that's going to be a terrible threat to us unless we can work out amicable solutions to these kinds of problems. You have Indians that are putting millions of cars on the road every year. You know, you got to work this stuff out. And the way to do it is to negotiate. And, you know, it should be possible to do that.
Ray McGovern, founder of that admirable civic-minded organization, Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. He is also co-director of the Servant Leadership School in Washington, D.C. This is a nonprofit organization that describes itself as, quote, a catalyst for Christian discipleship, theological reflection, and social activism, unquote. www.slsschool.org. I love that ironic suggestion by McGovern that every courthouse in the land should have a plaque listing the Five Commandments. In the late 60s, Beatle John Lennon shocked pious churchgoers when he noted, quite correctly, that the Beatles, quote, are more popular than Jesus Christ, unquote. As usual, the public outrage was entirely misplaced. Lennon didn't say the Beatles were better than Jesus Christ, preferable to Jesus Christ. Rather, he said the Beatles were more popular. I think Jesus would have been the first to agree. One more sign of Americans' insistence on confusing religion with entertainment, with the Armed Forces Recruiting Center, with celebrity, with flag-waving patriotism and military conquest, with everything except matters religious. A few years before Lennon spoke the truth, another musical organization made a similar point with great wit. In the 1960 musical Bye Bye Birdie, rock and roll idol Conrad Birdie is being drafted and sent overseas. His manager comes up with a publicity stunt. They'll have a lottery, and one girl member of his fan club will win the chance to give Conrad a goodbye kiss on the Ed Sullivan Show. Her whole family gets to appear on the show with her. Ed Sullivan was an extremely popular variety show broadcast on network TV each Sunday evening. And it came to pass that the lottery was won by the Virgin Kim McAfee of Sweet Apple, Ohio. Naturally, she's pleased. Her father, Harry McAfee, is glorified. The chance to be famous for 15 seconds, to appear on Ed Sullivan, is a transforming religious experience for him. And he acts as though the Lord had appeared unto him and spake, "Blessed art thou, Harry McAfee, for thou art saved." You can hear what a religious experience this was for Harry. Just listen to the instrumental music, which is not too different from Handel's Messiah. Don't miss that Amen cadence on Ed's name. The piece is titled Hymn for a Sunday Evening.
Sullivan Show?
Ed Sullivan.
Me, Harry McAfee, appearing with
Ed Sullivan.
Ed Sullivan. Ed Sullivan. Ed Sullivan.
Sullivan, Ed Sullivan, we're gonna
wonderful wife, two swell kids, a good business, and now this.
Someday we'll recall the greatest day of all.
Ed, I love you.
Ed,
and before going to the broadcast studio, I assume Kim McAfee washed her hair with new improved Halo shampoo. I still remember the advertising jingle. Halo is the shampoo that glorifies your hair. You know I'm not clever enough to make this stuff up. Usually this show moves rapidly from the sublime to the ridiculous. For once, let's try the opposite and move from the McAfees to Martin Luther King Jr. Like the prophet Jesus, King is more honored than paid attention to. But sometimes, if for once you actually pay attention to the words, you find yourself thinking, wow, that dude's proposing we create a world very different from the one we live in. Well, yes, he is. People like that are dangerous to the established order. I'll play some excerpts from King's great anti-war address at Riverside Church, delivered on April 4, 1967. 1 year to the day before the danger to the established order that his life represented was eliminated by agents of the national security state, and blamed on some sad sack lone gunman acting alone as usual. Just make one substitution. When King says Vietnam, just substitute the oil-rich Middle East. I'll say goodbye here and now, and thanks for listening, and remind you that, as some old book says somewhere, blessed are the peacemakers. Amen.
Tonight, however, I wish not to speak with Hanoi and the National Liberation Front, but rather to my fellow Americans. That is, at the outset, a very obvious and almost facile connection between the war in Vietnam and the struggle I and others have been waging in America. A few years ago, there was a shining moment in that struggle. It seemed as if there was a real promise of hope for the poor, both black and white, through the poverty program. There were experiments, hopes, new beginnings. Then came the build-up in Vietnam, and I watched this program broken and eviscerated, as if it was some idle political plaything of a society gone mad on war. And I knew that America would never invest the necessary funds or energies in rehabilitation of its poor so long as adventures like Vietnam continued to draw men and skills and money like some demonic destructive suction tube. So I was increasingly compelled to see the war as an enemy of the poor and to attack it as such. Perhaps a more tragic recognition of reality took place when it became clear to me that the war was doing far more than devastating the hopes of the poor at home. It was sending their sons and their brothers and their husbands to fight and to die in extraordinarily high proportions relative to the rest of the population. We were taking the black young men who had been crippled by our society and sending them 8,000 miles away to guarantee liberties in Southeast Asia, which they had not found in Southwest Georgia and East Holland. So we have been repeatedly faced with the cruel irony of watching Negro and white boys on TV screens as they kill and die together for a nation that has been unable to seat them together in the same schools. So we watch them in brutal solidarity burning the huts of a poor village. But we realized that they would hardly live on the same block in Chicago. I could not be silent in the face of such cruel manipulation of the poor. My third reason moves to an even deeper level of awareness. for it grows out of my experience in the ghettos of the North over the last 3 years, especially the last 3 summers. As I have walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men, I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. I have tried to offer them my deepest compassion while maintaining my conviction that social change comes most meaningfully through nonviolent action. But they ask, and rightly so, what about Vietnam? They ask if our own nation wasn't using massive doses of violence to solve its problems, to bring about the changes it wanted. Their questions hit home, and I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. For the sake of those boys, for the sake of this government, for the sake of the hundreds of thousands trembling under our violence, I cannot be silent. Another burden of responsibility was placed upon me in 1954, and I cannot forget that the Nobel Peace Prize was also a commission to work harder than I had ever worked before for the brotherhood of man. This is a calling that takes me beyond national allegiances. But even if it were not present, I would yet have to live with the meaning of my commitment to the ministry of Jesus Christ. To me, the relationship of this ministry to the making of peace is so obvious that I sometimes marvel at those who ask me why I am speaking against the war. Could it be that they do not know that the good news was meant for all men, for communists and capitalists, for their children and ours, for black and for white, for revolutionary and conservative? Have they forgotten that my ministry is in obedience to the one who loved his enemies so fully that he died for them? What then can I say to the Viet Cong, or to Castro, or to Mao as a faithful minister of this one? Can I threaten them with death, or must I not share with them my life? I am as deeply concerned about our own troops there as anything else. We are adding cynicism to the process of death, for they must know after the short period there that none of the things we claim to be fighting for are really involved. But I wish to go on now to say something even more disturbing. The war in Vietnam is but a symptom of a far deeper malady within the American spirit. And if we ignore this sobering reality, we will find ourselves organizing clergy and layman concern committees for the next generation. They will be concerned about Guatemala and Peru. They will be concerned about Thailand and Cambodia. They will be concerned about Mozambique and South Africa. We will be marching for these and a dozen other names and attending rallies without end, unless there is a significant and profound change in American life and policy.
Thou shalt not take thy mark. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Thou shalt not hate thy mark. Thou shalt not commit adultery.